On April 22, 1978, two men who had spent years ordering murders walked onto the same stage and held hands in front of 32,000 people, not because they had forgiven each other, not because the killing had stopped, but because a reggae singer refused to finish his song until they did. Nobody in that stadium, not the politicians, not the gunmen watching from the wings, not the journalists furiously scribbling in the dark, could explain what they had just witnessed. And here is the detail that almost no one mentions when they tell this story. Both men were dead within 2 years. Keep that in your mind. We will come back to it. Jamaica in 1972 was 10 years free from British colonial rule and already fracturing along lines that independence had not healed. The People's National Party, under Michael Manley, and the Jamaica Labour Party, under Edward Seeger, had divided the island, not just politically, but geographically. In Kingston's inner city neighborhoods, garrison communities had been constructed around party loyalty. Your block determined your politics. Your politics could determine whether you lived or died. By the mid-1970s, political violence between armed partisan gangs had turned sections of Kingston into occupied territory, and the Jamaican government had declared a state of emergency in 1976 following an election so violent it entered the historical record as one of the most dangerous in Caribbean history. And yet, from inside that exact pressure, the most influential music movement the Caribbean has ever produced was being born. This is where most documentaries make their first mistake. They reach immediately for Bob Marley. He becomes the shorthand, the summary, the beginning and end of the story. But roots reggae was not a man. It was a movement, and it was generated by the same forces that were tearing the island apart. The Rastafarian faith, which had been growing in Jamaica's poorest communities since the 1930s, provided the theological architecture. Haile Selassie of Ethiopia was regarded by Rastafarians as a living deity, the fulfillment of biblical prophecy, the African king who would lead the black diaspora back from Babylon. Babylon in Rasta philosophy was not a place. It was a system: colonialism, capitalism, police violence, the IMF, and every structure that kept black people poor and obedient. When that theology collided with the political desperation of Kingston's ghetto youth in the early 1970s, the result was music that didn't ask for change. It demanded it. Burning Spear, Culture, Peter Tosh, Bunny Wailer, these were not entertainers filling arenas. They were preachers with amplifiers, delivering sermons that the Jamaican church would never sanction. Their lyrics drew directly from the Book of Revelation, from Marcus Garvey's Pan-African philosophy, from Walter Rodney's radical scholarship, and from the lived, daily experience of watching your neighbor get shot for wearing the wrong color on the wrong street. Now close your eyes for a moment and step into Kingston. Not the Kingston of the travel brochure, the real one. It is 1976. The election is 6 weeks away. The air in Trenchtown smells of diesel and charcoal smoke and something metallic that the older residents recognize and the younger ones are learning to. The zinc fences along the lane are painted, half in orange, half in green. Someone has sprayed a slogan on the wall of the standpipe: Babylon must fall. A sound system is set up in the yard, a tower of hand-built wooden speaker boxes painted black, wired together with cables thick as rope. The selector drops the needle. The bass hits before the treble does. You feel it in your chest before you hear it with your ears. And then the voice comes. Not smooth, not polished, but raw and urgent and true. And for the 3 minutes that song plays, the lane is not a war zone, it is a congregation. Now here is the question, and answer it honestly. Wherever you are listening to this right now, if you are in London, if you are in Toronto, if you are in New York, when was the last time you played that music in your house? Not as background noise, not as nostalgia, but as the thing it was built to be. A signal, a reminder, a refusal, because what happened next is exactly what happens when a signal gets too strong for those in power to ignore. Michael Manley was shrewd enough to understand what reggae represented. Between 1969 and 1972, he actively cultivated the energy of the Rastafarian movement and the Black Power ideology spreading from North America, positioning himself as the people's champion against colonial economic structures. He carried a wooden staff, a gift he claimed had been given to him by Emperor Haile Selassie himself, and called it the Rod of Correction. It was political theatre of the highest order. Historians who have studied the 1972 election confirm that reggae music functioned as an organizing force that helped deliver Manley his landslide victory. But the music was never loyal to any politician. That was its power. By 1978, the garrison violence had reached a point where even the gunmen were exhausted. Two inner-city warlords, Claude Massop, aligned with the JLP, and Bucky Marshall, aligned with the PNP, made a decision that their respective political handlers almost certainly did not authorize. They called a truce, and to mark it, they organized a concert. 16 of reggae's greatest acts. National Stadium, April 22, 1978. 32,000 people. The One Love Peace concert is remembered for the moment. You know the image. Bob Marley, stopping mid-performance, walking to the edge of the stage, calling Manley and Seeger up from their seats, taking a hand of each man, men whose supporters had been killing each other for years, raising their joined hands over his head and holding them there. 32,000 people held their breath. Then they erupted. And here is the detail that history keeps burying. Claude Massop, the man who co-organized that moment of peace, was shot and killed in January 1979, 9 months after the concert. Bucky Marshall, who stood across from him on that stage, was also killed within 2 years. The peace did not hold. The violence resumed. The political machinery that had armed those communities had no incentive to disarm them. What held was the music. What survived and spread was the idea that a small island's culture could carry enough truth and enough fire to make two enemies hold hands in front of 32,000 witnesses. That idea was about to leave the island. Before we follow the diaspora, we need to understand what the island was producing in its kitchens and its fields, because the food and the music were not separate stories. They were the same story told through different senses. Travel with me now, not to Kingston, but into the mountains above it. The Blue Mountains, where the air is cooler and the clouds sit so low they drape across the ridgeline like a cloth. Up here, in the 1970s, Rastafarian communes were farming land that plantation owners had long abandoned as too steep, too remote, too unprofitable. And they were farming it in a way that the island's colonial agricultural history had never sanctioned. They called their food philosophy ital, from the word vital, and it was not a diet, it was a theology expressed through the kitchen. No salt, no meat, no processed food, no chemical additives, cookware made from clay rather than metal, because metal was Babylon's material. The ingredients came directly from the earth: yam, breadfruit, kalaloo, dried peas, coconut milk, cassava, plantain, grown without industrial inputs, harvested by hand, cooked slowly over wood fire. A Rastafarian ital kitchen in 1975 looked functionally like what food scientists and climate researchers in 2026 are now urgently calling for: a locally sourced, plant-forward, regenerative food system. The Rastas were not ahead of their time. The rest of the world simply took 50 years to catch up. What Ital understood, and what Western nutritional science is now confirming, is that the soil and the spirit are not separate concerns. You do not eat to fuel a body that is separate from the earth. You eat to maintain a relationship with the earth. Today, 10% of Jamaicans identify as vegetarian or vegan, a figure directly traceable to the Rastafarian movement's influence on the island's food culture, a penetration rate that exceeds many Western nations that market veganism as a modern lifestyle innovation. Meanwhile, at the base of those same mountains, down where the coast curves northeast toward Portland Parish, and the air carries the smell of the sea, a completely different food tradition was feeding a completely different hunger: the jerk pit. Here is what most accounts of Jamaican jerk get wrong. They begin with the seasoning. The seasoning is not the story. The story begins with survival. Jerk cooking did not originate in a restaurant. It was born in a mountain hideout. The Maroons, enslaved Africans who escaped Spanish plantations and retreated into Jamaica's interior, needed a way to cook meat without producing the one thing that could get them killed: visible smoke. A covered pit, dug into the earth, slow cooking seasoned meat over coals made from pimento wood, The allspice tree native to Jamaica produced almost no plume. You could cook a full animal 300 meters from a patrol and leave no trace. That technique, carried down through generations of Maroon communities, is what eventually became the most globally recognized cooking method the Caribbean has ever produced. The pimento tree is the soul of authentic jerk. Its wood produces a fragrant, sweet smoke that cannot be replicated, not by hickory, not by oak, not by any wood grown outside Jamaica's volcanic soil. Jamaica's Culinary Institute has formally codified this. For a dish to carry the designation of authentic Jamaican jerk, it must be smoked over pimento wood. Every jerk seasoning sold in a London Tesco, every jerk chicken sold at a food truck in Toronto, every jerk-inspired dish on a New York menu, all of it traces back to that mountain pit, to those Maroon hands, to that act of cooking as resistance. The modern headquarters of jerk is Boston Beach in Portland Parish, a stretch of roadside stalls on the northeastern coast where vendors have been cooking over open pimento wood pits for generations, serving chicken and pork wrapped in foil, with festival bread on the side. No tablecloths, no reservation, no Michelin star, just fire, pimento smoke, scotch bonnet heat, and the kind of flavor that silences a person mid-sentence. That detail you filed away at the start of this story, the two men who organized the peace concert and were both dead within 2 years, holds a lesson that the food traditions of this island already understood long before the politicians arrived. Survival is not guaranteed by treaty. It is guaranteed by knowledge, by technique, by passing down, generation to generation, the specific, irreplaceable way of doing a thing that keeps you alive and keeps you free. Now we follow the people. From the late 1940s onward, Jamaicans began leaving, not because they wanted to, but because the economy of the island, shaped by centuries of colonial extraction and post-independence, structural adjustment, could not hold everyone. The first wave went to Britain as part of the Windrush generation, responding to active recruitment by the British government, which needed labor to rebuild a nation destroyed by war. They staffed the NHS. They drove the buses. They laid the rail lines. They were told, explicitly, that they were British subjects coming home to the motherland, and they arrived to find signs in the windows of boarding houses that read, "No Irish, no blacks, no dogs." They stayed anyway, and they built. In London's Brixton and Notting Hill, in Birmingham and Bristol, Jamaican communities constructed the infrastructure of cultural survival, community centers, sound systems, churches, food shops. They held back-to-back parties, blues parties, in their front rooms, charging a shilling at the door, playing ska and rock steady, and then reggae, until the neighbors called the police, and the police came and found 100 people refusing to go home. By the 1970s, Jamaican music was seeping into British youth culture at every level, influencing punk rock, feeding the two-tone movement, and laying the foundation for what would eventually become grime, UK garage and Afrobeats as a British phenomenon. In Toronto, a neighborhood on Eglinton Avenue West became known as Little Jamaica, a concentrated enclave of Jamaican-Canadian life, where patty shops, sound system venues, barbershops, and community organizations preserved and evolved the culture across generations. The Caribbean-descended population of Toronto now represents 12% of the city's total population. In New York, in Flatbush, Brooklyn, and sections of the Bronx, Jamaican cultural influence embedded itself into the city's music scene so completely that the history of hip-hop cannot be written without acknowledging it. DJ Kool Herc, the Jamaican-born DJ, who is credited as one of the founding fathers of hip-hop, brought the sound system tradition, the same tradition built in those Kingston yards, the same towering speaker boxes, the same MC culture, directly from Jamaica to the South Bronx. Think about that. The next time someone tells you hip-hop is an American invention, understand this. Its foundational architecture was built by a man from Kingston, applying techniques developed in Trenchtown. If you are Jamaican, or of Jamaican descent, and you are listening to this in London, or Toronto, or New York, you already know what it cost. You know what it meant to grow up, explaining your food to people who had never heard of Aki, to defend your music to people who dismissed it as island stuff, to translate your parents' patois, to to a world that treated the most expressive language in the Caribbean as broken English. You carried this culture in your body. You performed it at carnival and in church, and at every family gathering. You kept it alive without being asked to and without being thanked for it. And what came back to Jamaica because of what you built? Everything. The global demand for reggae that the diaspora created turned Jamaican music into a cultural export worth billions. The Jamaican tourism industry, which generated $4 billion in 2024 from 4.27 million visitors, is sustained in significant part by diaspora travel, by the specific irreplaceable desire to go back, to show children where they come from, to stand in Portland Parish and smell pimento smoke and understand in your body what your parents were always trying to tell you. Jamaica is now ranked among the top 5 cultural brands in the world, a nation of 3 million people, ranking alongside countries of hundreds of millions. That is not a statistic, that is the return on what you invested when you carried the culture across the water and refused to let it die, and still the island remains. Port Antonio in the 1970s was barely accessible. 2 treacherous hours over the Blue Mountains from Kingston, it sat at the edge of Jamaica's wild northeastern coast, largely untouched by the tourism that was already reshaping Montego Bay and Ocho Rios. The Maroons of the Blue and John Crow Mountains had ensured for centuries that this territory resisted easy penetration. That resistance preserved something extraordinary, a landscape of vertiginous, almost confrontational beauty that no resort developer had yet managed to flatten and package. The Blue Mountains rise to over 7,400 feet. They are wreathed in cloud. The forest that covers them is some of the most biodiverse mountain ecosystem in the Caribbean basin. And from the volcanic soil of their upper slopes comes one of the world's most coveted agricultural products, Jamaica Blue Mountain coffee. Grown at altitude, shaped by the cool mountain air and the mineral richness of soil laid down by millions of years of geological pressure, Blue Mountain coffee carries a flavor, mild, smooth, with a subtle chocolate finish that commands premium prices in coffee markets from New York to Tokyo. In 2025, the Jamaica Blue Mountain Coffee Festival launched a new chapter in the island's relationship with that crop, combining farm tours, sustainability workshops, and barista competitions into a cultural tourism product that transforms an agricultural tradition into an immersive experience. Climate researchers working with Blue Mountain farmers in 2026 are calling for a transition to bird-friendly, shade-grown, community-centered farming practices to protect the ecosystem against the increasingly destabilizing effects of climate change. The language they are using, regenerative, community-rooted, locally sustained, is once again the language the Itl farmers in those same mountains were already speaking 50 years ago. The island keeps telling you the same story in different dialects. And now finally, we can answer the question that was planted at the beginning. Claude Massop and Bucky Marshall organized the One Love Peace concert. They brought the enemies to the stage. They made the moment happen, and both of them were dead within 2 years. For decades, that fact has been filed as a tragedy. Proof that the peace failed, that the music couldn't hold, that Jamaica's violence was stronger than any single gesture of reconciliation. But consider the alternative reading. The peace was never meant to last. The political machine that had armed those communities depended on the violence to maintain its grip on the garrison vote. Massop and Marshall both knew this. They were not naive men. They were men who had survived in one of the most dangerous political environments in the Western Hemisphere. And knowing all of that, they organized the concert anyway. They forced the moment anyway. They made the 2 most powerful politicians in Jamaica hold hands in front of 32,000 witnesses anyway, creating an image so indelible that 48 years later, it is still being discussed on stages, in universities, in documentaries, and in audiobooks produced on the other side of the world. They didn't survive, but the image did, and that is the Jamaican story, in its purest form. Not the survival of individuals, the survival of the signal, the music, the food, the technique, the culture, passed forward through Maroon Mountain kitchens, through Kingston Yards, through Brixton Blues parties, through Flatbush sound systems, through Toronto patty shops, through Blue Mountain coffee farms, until it reaches you wherever you are, still carrying the frequency of an island that refused to be compressed into silence. So here is the question this story leaves you with, and there is no easy answer. Jamaica gave its culture to the world. The world made billions from it. The island made far less. Is that the price of influence, or the evidence of a theft that is still ongoing?